This is Wells Tech, a show that explores the intersection of technology and ministry. Wells Tech is a part of the Streams Media Network sponsored by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Your show hosts are Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. Join the conversation at wellstech.wells.net. Hello again, everybody. This is Wells Tech, a show about technology and ministry and where those two intersect. This is episode 433 for Tuesday, February 23rd, 2016. My name is Martin Spriggs, and I'm joined, as usual, by Sally Draper. Hello, Sally. How are you?
Good afternoon, Martin. I am just fine, but feeling a little bit of a bittersweet twinge this afternoon as I am recording my last podcast from the lovely Martin Luther College campus. I'll be saying goodbye to this office next Monday officially and returning to working out of my home. So next Tuesday when we record, it'll be from a different location.
Is that why you're wearing the Martin Luther sweatshirt in honor of the...
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, showing my MLC pride. What a blessing it's been to be here on campus.
Absolutely, yeah. So you're going to come work for us full-time. Not that you really weren't full-time before, but boy, that was one of your swan songs. One of your legacies now is the brand new MLC website, right?
Me and many others were definitely involved in that effort, and really excited about it and happy that it's live and going very well, I must say. We remarked the other day that it's been kind of a non-event, which is a good thing when you make a major change like that, to not have caused any major waves or anything.
Yeah, and probably a great, good timing because we've been writing this book all along, and that's a huge project management effort, all kinds of moving parts and considerations, and you throw in your treasure house stuff, and you've got project management stuff coming out of your ears. So good to have that behind you, and next week we'll see you in the comfy confines of the Draper Estate.
That's right. Not as good a lighting, I don't think. I think this is pretty favorable to my podcasting complexion, but we'll make it work.
Lighting, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
but we're not going to talk about our project management book just yet. That is in a few weeks yet. We are going to have a feedback show. So once a month, we pick a show that we gather up all the feedback we received from the previous weeks, and we go through it all, or most of it, we chit-chat about it a little bit. I think I learned maybe more on these shows than anything else, as our listeners have shared some of the things that they've found. We've done a little bit of our own research and come out the other end a little bit better for it, because there's so many things out there that you could... That you could find that would fit in that intersection of technology and ministry. And we've got a good lineup today, as usual.
Yep, lots to talk about. And a great question to kick it off, Martin. We heard from Pastor Fred Kogler, who is someone I'm really proud to be associated with. He has a Facebook group on devotions, but he does it with videos. I should probably share my screen. Pastor Kogler, I would say he would agree that he's one of our more elder Wells Tech listeners, and he's out there on Facebook and making digital imprint with his devotions. He shares some things from his workshop and different things, but for the most part, shares video devotions via this Facebook group. And he's looking and thinking in terms of delivering video for Bible information class. And that's really what he wrote to us about, was whether we were aware of anyone who was doing video BIC classes, Bible information classes, or has archived Bible information classes online somewhere that other people could take advantage of. And, I think that's a great question, Pastor Kogler. Good thinking, but unfortunately, I don't really have any resources to point him to, and I wonder if our audience might.
Yep, great question. I think over the years, we've heard from a few who have tried or dabbled a little bit in Skyping, these kinds of things, but now the tools are there, and this is not a difficult thing. And I'm sure many of our congregations are in settings where distance learning, confirmation class, those kinds of things with real-time video is totally in a doable state. So neat.
Yep. So let us know if you have anything like that going on that we're not aware of. We'd love to include links on the Wells Tech page, maybe in our Wells Tech Wiki, whatever it might be. Certainly get in touch with us with that. Another email-centric communication that we got was from Pastor Dwayne Schmiegel, who serves in the Twin Cities area. I'm not exactly sure. I probably have it here in the email, but congregation in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And he asked a question regarding his email being tagged as spam. And he prefaced his question that he often sends out frequent emails to the congregation, like forwarding the Wells Daily Devotion, reminder emails, prayer requests, etc. And he at times is labeled as a spammer by different servers that are out there receiving his mail. So he was asking how to get around this, how to stop his email from being labeled as spam. And being the Googler that I am, I took to the internet to find an answer for him and found this really helpful page. It's from a site called In Motion Hosting, and it's titled exactly what I said, How Do I Stop My Emails from Being Labeled as Spam? And they kind of walk through what would cause an email to be labeled as spam, and so that you can ensure you really aren't violating any of the regulations and things around that, and then some steps to take to ensure that this doesn't happen, one of which is to write to the people that you're sending to and ask them to whitelist your email address so that it doesn't get flagged. Another would be to actually look at those bounce messages and see if you've been added to some blacklist somewhere and contact the list managers to get your email address removed from a blacklist. And it gets into a little more technical things around spoofing and things like that. It also suggests, Martin, that you might consider using an email host or a tool like MailChimp or Constant Contact to send out group emails, because basically you're sending to a really large group of people, it's going to think that perhaps you're spamming people. And so yep. Using a host system like that is a good idea.
Yeah, that's the thing that immediately came to my mind, is that you gain a lot of benefits from doing that anyway. We've talked about those before. If you use something like MailChimp, it handles that, and it kind of bears the load and the Gmails of the world, and the email carriers, the big email carriers of the world, kind of know that these big mail or newsletter kinds of companies exist, and typically they don't get blacklisted. Another benefit of using one of those kinds of systems is you have better tracking. So if you're sending emails through them, you have some analytics. You know who's opening them, how many get opened, what links were clicked. You have a little more intelligence about how your emails are doing. If you're just using your own email system, you really don't have much of a clue how it's doing, if people open them or those kinds of things. So that suggests that a tool like MailChimp or Constant Contact is probably the best way to go. Even for smaller, short emails, it really doesn't matter. You can do it any way you want. And for the most part, most of our congregations would qualify for the free account. I think it's like 5,000 emails per month, and most of our congregations would not exceed that. So I think that's
I'm
the way
thinking
to go anyway.
Voice of experience here, if you ever happen to be assigned to Sleepy Eye, Minnesota, and are responsible for notifying when school is closed because of weather, it's nice to have MailChimp set up, because you get to just repurpose that email over and over again when the weather closes the school many, many times in the winter. Just kind of fun to be able to rely on that tool for
that. Another nice thing, if you use some of these email tools like MailChimp, is you can format your email in a way through them that'll look good on most inbox clients, which is really hard if you want to get fancy with your own. You never quite know how it's going to get formatted. We've learned from experience here at Wells that, boy, there's so many different varieties. Outlook is actually one of the hardest to format for, because they don't adhere to any standards. So using a tool like MailChimp helps you with that as well. So just a little tip there. Also, you also give your recipients a chance to subscribe or unsubscribe, which is usually a good thing, rather than just pushing it out. You give them a choice. So Great question, yeah. though.
Good advice. All right. Next, we took a look at our Twitter feed, and there were quite a few in there that Martin himself provided. So
let's take a look at those. Couple from the same website, TNW News or The Next Web. One I came across, and I'm really looking forward to trying this out a little bit, a product called Anchor. It's an iOS app that allows you to do audio blogging. The name of the article is Anchor for iOS Brings Audio Blogging Back from the Dead. I think it's coming to Android, but it's not there yet. It is only on iOS today. But basically, it is just a dead simple way to record your own audio and then publish it as a podcast. You can think of all kinds of applications for this. When you were talking about Fred Kogler's email, he does audio and video devotions. Here is a way just to do a simple audio devotion, get it out to your congregation or out there on the internet. You can subscribe it to the RSS feeders so that people can get notified that this exists. They've slimmed down the interface, so there's just a red button you press and it starts recording. It tells you how long. The microphone on the iOS devices are great, so you're going to get really good quality, and it's free. There's no cost to it. So this is a product called Anchor. So if you've been thinking about maybe doing a podcast, whether it's maybe a daily devotion or a daily conversation or something, whatever it is, I think a lot of people have podcast ideas, and it can be of any length. This might be a good a good solution for you. They've got the whole social networking side of it baked in here too, so people can follow the podcast, etc. You can push it out to Facebook, those kinds of things. So thought that was good news, especially for people who are, again, trying to find those intersections of technology and ministry. Here's a way to capture audio and get it out to people who may be interested in what you have to say.
I like it.
Also from The Next Web, another article I found over the last month was some bad news. We've talked about this before, Sally. Google shutters its Play for Education program to focus on Chromebooks in the classroom. This was something that I think we talked about with Jason Schmidt, as I recall. Because he was high on this for finding apps for Android tablets, and Google Play for Education was kind of the store for that. So apparently Google has decided that there wasn't enough of a market there and really wanted to refocus their energy all into the Chromebook space, which I guess is not all that surprising because of how well Chromebooks are doing. Maybe tablets aren't the way to go because of the adoption of Chromebooks. So if you were thinking about testing the waters here for Google Play for Education, which I think launched in 2013, it says here in the article, you're going to be out of luck. So a little bit of bad news coming from Google. And I can't say that I played around a lot with it because I wasn't in that situation, but sounded promising, and unfortunately it's going away.
Yeah, it looked like from the article, Martin, that if you have existing Play for Education licenses, those will continue to work. You're grandfathered in. So that's good news for those that have made the investment there. I'm guessing those devices that they're using them on won't have a lifetime length of existence, but for the devices you have it on, it looks like you can continue to use it.
Yeah, and those apps don't exist in other places other than in the Google Play for Education store. I mean, they're standalone apps that you can launch. But what Google Play for Education did was offering a subscription program where you get multiple licenses and download up to multiple devices. So
and manage it through the app's admin panel as well.
Exactly, right. Okay. And then the last thing I tweeted out over the past month was about one of our favorite project management tools. We've mentioned it a number of times on the show. That's Trello. Found a little article on the internet. Trello is Trello is a handy project management tool. And the article came from, I think it was on Trello's blog itself. Let me see if I can open that up quick here. Trello maintains a blog, which I subscribe to. Optimize your, that's not the right one. Where did it go? Did I link to it? They were talking about, oh, maybe it was. This one is optimize your employee manual with these three tips. I don't think that's correct, though. And the one I tweeted, let's see if I can find it here. Usually they're right on the front page. It was a really good article. maybe I'm in the wrong place. Anyway, let me go back to where I was. Basically, they were talking about an employee manual. Yeah, that is the right one. So they created a on Trello and the ability to kind of include all the things that would maybe be part of an onboarding process, all the things that each employee on your team or in your church or school would need to know. And if you're not familiar with Trello, it's kind of a card-based system. You can put cards in different lists and lists on different boards. So it's a very intuitive thing, and it's graphically pleasing. You can drag cards around and you can add checklists and notifications, those kinds of things. And I think it would make a really good dashboard, you know, in that kind of setting, if you've got employees or people or even volunteers who need to know information. You just send them to the board and they can go through the information that's on it. Just a good way to organize information. Sally, you are an accomplished Trello user. You probably think of 101 different ways to use Trello other than the ways we're using it, and this is just one more.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, actually, and you mentioned onboarding volunteers. Is that not a constant effort, you know, where I can remember trying to get people into the church management software to input the offerings as they count each Sunday, and there was a whole crew of people, and very often they needed to reference the same documentation or, you know, get help with the same kind of sticking point that they might have or whatever. Right. And having it on a Trello board and organized where they could just pull it up really quickly and jump to the exact thing organized on a board.
You can include images. I don't know if you can embed video. Maybe you can. I haven't actually tried that.
Certainly could link to it.
Sure, certainly could link to it. Yeah, so you have all kinds of things that you could put in, you know, this and just direct them there, and they could work their way across the board, and depending on who they are, they could jump into the right categories. So yeah, lots of opportunities. And Trello is a free tool for the most part. I mean, we pay for it here at the Synod level because we use some of the advanced features, but for a lot of congregations, I would think the free version would work just fine.
So. Yeah, I could even imagine maybe your worship planning group, so your organist getting in there and your usher schedules and things like that, seeing how things jive.
Yep, so, very easy to just click and type, and yeah, it's very simple. So good. Mm-hmm. That's all I had from Twitter, Sally.
One more tweet that we want to share came to us. They made a mention of Wells Tech. This was from A Mighty Fortress, which is in Hiram, Georgia, I believe. And they said, thank you, Wells Tweets and Wells Tech, for digital media for our new monitor in the Narthex. So they included a nice picture of their new monitor that they've obviously mounted there in their Narthex, and it obviously, I would think, scrolls through different images on the monitor, and they're including some from the Wells Image Library, and I have that up on my computer as well, where you can go and download digital display and PowerPoint graphics, and different displays created for all kinds of different things going on through Wells, everything from Wells Night at Miller Park, to My Son, My Savior, to the upcoming International Youth Rally, the Heart to Heart Parent Conversations, Wells Mobile App, and even Wells Tech. So we've got you covered if you want to include some really professionally done, high quality imagery to intermix with different announcements and things you may be including on your digital display. It was really neat to see the picture.
Pick and choose what you want and just to promote what you want. But lots of high quality graphics, and a shout out to our designer here at Wells, Brianna, who does all of these. She does just a super job. So take advantage of that.
Martin, we wouldn't want to miss out on Pinterest pins. And ironically, one of the pins was from you.
Yes. I'm very proud of that fact. I installed the plugin in my browser and everything to do it. Unfortunately, now when I hover over any image in any browser page, I'm reminded that Pinterest is installed because it pops up with that little a little red image there that says, hey, do you want to pin this? Hey, do you want to pin
this? Did you say fortunately? Fortunately, that happens?
Did I say fortunately?
I think you must have.
That's what you probably heard, yeah. Anyway, I'll get over it. But I did find an image, and I was kind of playing around with some of these social networking plugins as well, so it was a good opportunity to do that. But so I found a story on Church Tech Today, one of our favorite blogs, and it's called Storytelling, Video, and Your Church. So they go through kind of a neat, let me go actually to the site here rather than the image that I
share. Share your screen.
Oh, yep, right. Good. Thank you. For all you viewers, here we go. So on Church Tech Today, Storytelling, Video, and Your Church, they talk about the importance or the value of the concept of story, of telling stories. And they, they have the pop-up ad here. They talk about exposition, inciting incident, compounding problem, climax, resolution, moral, and then kind of a big application section. It gives you a kind of a nice walkthrough of things to think about as you're putting together video. So it's not just turning on the camera and recording an event. You want to tell a story. And this gives kind of the walkthrough. It's not a long article, but it's the salient points about how to capture video in a way that actually brings the user through and it tells them what's on your mind. So it kind of walks through a couple things from Toy Story. They use Toy Story as an example, and they pull out some interesting techniques that were used and how that whole story came together and actually how simple it is as you think about what a story is and the different segments of it. So they do a nice job here. So probably worth a quick read. Won't take you more than 10 minutes, but things to think about if you're interested in getting video on your website or using video to tell a story.
Excellent. Reminds me of Death by Meetings, the book where they likened videos to meetings and having conflict and things like that. Yep. So
always good to have a concrete example.
Yeah. All right. I did a little pinning myself this month, and it was just a one post. How often should you post on social media? I actually thought this one was pin worthy because it was an infographic, and it kind of gives you some guidelines to go by, how many things per day you should post to different types of social media, Pinterest, Twitter, Google+, and Facebook, because you obviously want to stay engaged with your audience, but you don't want to turn them off by flooding their feeds and things. So Pinterest is where we should be spending our time, apparently, Martin. We should be posting 5 posts per day. I think we're a little bit behind the curve on that one, but
not holding up my side of the bargain there.
Make that a concerted effort. This infographic/pin actually came from the Wells Intersections page over on Facebook, managed by Pastor Jim Aderman, and we're going to get to lots more from Intersections later in the show, but just a shout out to him for sharing that infographic.
Great. So that's our Pinterest segment. Let's go on to Digo, D-I-I-G-O.
A couple of things to share there, Martin. The first one is for those who are interested in 3D printing. This is super geeky, but shared by our friend Jason Schmidt, and it's called Moon 2 STL. And basically, it allows you to find an area of the moon and download a printable 3D file that you can print the topography of the moon's surface, basically, and you can move it around to different areas of the moon and decide what you want to select. You can zoom in and out and things like that, and once you have it the way you want it, you can push a button and download your file for 3D printing. So Jason didn't give us any comments on this when he posted it to Digo. I'm just thinking it's a combination of geekiness that's appropriate for sharing. Fun stuff. Yeah.
Sounds like a good application for a 3D printer.
Yeah, and a science class probably.
Right.
One more to share via Digo, and this one was actually something that our webmaster friend Julie Duran shared with us. Someone's looking for a free online photo editor, they need to look no further than freeonlinephotoeditor.com. It's kind of a PicMonkey type tool. It does have a lot of advertising. I actually have ad blocker turned on, so it's kind of hiding that from the view that I'm sharing on the video. But pretty straightforward. You can just drag and drop an image in here. You can click to browse your computer and upload. And once it's there, there's different menu commands right there on the screen where you can do basic things like resizing and cropping and rotating images. You can enhance your image in different ways. You can colorize your image in different ways. And the list goes on and on. I think there's a text overlay component that you can include. Bringing in other clip art type items, filters, and things like that. So if you wanted to give someone a super crash course on resizing images to certain dimensions for a website, for instance, seems like free online photo editor would be a good tool choice for you for those basic image editing needs.
Sally, you've been editing images online for a long time. Do you think there are any drawbacks or limitations, some things that you just can't do online that you maybe used to do on the desktop? Are you pretty happy with the experience right now with your favorite PicMonkey?
Well, you know, one thing that comes to mind, Martin, is I know in some more advanced image editors, you can control things like compression so that you can really be specific about your file size and the image quality and where that slider lands. And PicMonkey has basically three levels that you can pick from. But if you wanted to have more finesse about your image compression or on the GIF side, like the number of colors that are included in your GIF, if you want to skinny that image down a bit, maybe that's the kind of finesse that you're lacking with some of the online tools. But I know there's many online, I want to say Pixlr is one that is more of a Photoshop kind of parallel where it allows you to do layers and things. And so maybe it has some of those capabilities as well. But that's the one thing that jumps to mind is really controlling your image size and quality.
Right. And there's a whole nother category in that space too, and that's, you know, the tablet-based tools. You know, so instead of doing it on your computer, you've got them on your iPad or iPhone, and a lot of image editing could go on there too.
I think it does.
Probably some compromises, but yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Depends on what your needs are, I suppose.
Sure. All right. Next up, just to mention that over on our Wells Tech listserv, there's been a little bit of a conversation around treasurer positions. Staff Minister Dan Shuffle asked a question of the listserv of whether their treasurer position is a paid or hired position in larger congregations, especially that can be a pretty time-intensive and knowledge-intense job. And he got a good bit of feedback, especially from larger congregations, saying maybe they have the traditional treasurer and or financial secretary as an elected volunteer position on their church council or whatever, but that they outsource the bookkeeping aspects so that those people aren't, you know, loaded down with a heavy set of books to keep up with for larger congregations. So good feedback there. Just maybe not the perfect fit for the Wells Tech listserv. And I think Dan kind of said that in his question, but a good group to ask a question.
A good place to start, yeah, because there's very knowledgeable people there. We've got almost 500 people that get those emails, and that's a very good resource.
We do have connections a bit to the LinkedIn in the Wells group, and it has 1,350 members, so that might be another place that you might consider asking some of those general type questions via LinkedIn, especially since it has kind of that job focus, and this was a job kind of question. But, you know, certainly you could go and ask your Facebook friends that are Wells people or whatever. I mean, it's interesting as more and more online collaboration and social groups emerge where your channels are and what kind of people you have access to.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Next up in this fancy mind map we put together here is a look at an article from Google Plus, Wells Google Schools. And it actually is a little hashtag trick. And I would say this is one way to accomplish this. And what they're trying to get around here is that Google Classroom can send you a lot of email. If you put an assignment out there, oftentimes you'll get email you know, from 30 students or 60 students or whatever it may be as they're turning in their assignments and things. So the trick is to put a hashtag in the assignment title, and then it walks you through how in Gmail you can set up a filter that looks for those hashtags and sends them to a certain folder, or in Gmail terms, it applies a certain label to them. So you don't necessarily have to see them all in your inbox, but they can just automatically show up for you as a label in your Gmail, which shows up in the folder structure and things. So a nice little trick. There's probably multiple ways to accomplish this, but this is certainly one that would do the trick for you. So good find.
Very powerful. We've talked about filters in the past, some productivity tips there for circling back on commitments that have been made and you know, waiting for lists, those kinds of things. And this is just another example of the power of anything that you can get consistently coming into your email, you can create a filter for and then kind of shove away. And you can even tell Gmail to you know, give you a count, you know, on the category or folder or whatever the tag that is in Gmail, so that you're not going to miss it. So just a good way to keep it out of your inbox and make you more productive. I can't even imagine, I mean, if you're assigning, you know, something every other day or something like that, how much your stuff is going to flow into that inbox. And this is just a good way to, you know, parse it out a little bit,
right? Keep it clean. Mm-hmm. So all right, I think it's time to focus on Facebook. And the first thing I wanted to share about Facebook is that we're actually at 496 likes on our Facebook page, Martin. So if we could just entice four people to like our page, we'd break that 500 barrier. So if you already like our page, maybe you want to share it with someone else and spread the Wells Tech love a little bit further. But we really would like to reach the 500 likes level. And so please do share that out there. And then
no
prizes
or anything, just a sense of satisfaction.
Wells Intersections, a public group that's out on Facebook. You can certainly join it. Looks like their membership is growing all the time. Again, this is managed by Pastor Jim Aderman, and he is just finding some really great stuff to share with the group here at Wells Intersections. This kind of grew out of our Wells Tech Conference last summer, and there's a physical group that meets in the Milwaukee area, and it certainly you're invited to be a part of that, but virtually you can be a part of the group by joining it at Wells Intersections. So a few things to share from Pastor Aderman's post this past month. One is an article titled, Seven Tools to Create an Infographic in 30 Minutes, Design Skills or Not. And the guy that wrote the article even recorded himself building an infographic in 3 minutes. So it does point out some tools that I was aware of and some that I hadn't been familiar with in the past. Number one on the list is Canva. We've talked about that several times. Very professional looking online design tool. The price is free. Sometimes they include background imagery and things that are pay for, but you can always delete that imagery and provide your own or you know, whatever you want to do. They have free images to pick from as well. But he went on to list six more, and of those, I think I'd only heard of one. There's Vengage, and he has examples from each of these. PictoChart, we've talked about on the show before, another infographic generator, very powerful tool. Easily, I don't know if we've heard of that one before, Martin.
Nope.
VizMe, and Infogram, are there six or seven? One more. Visualize Me. Maybe we've talked about that one.
Talked about that one, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but definitely a picture's worth a thousand words these days, and these infographics kind of merge pictures and words and really convey some great information. So if you have something to share, try out one of these tools. Make it a learning experience and give them a try. Many of them are free or they have pro accounts that you can opt into as well. So
one application that I've often thought of that I haven't seen very often for infographics is the church's annual report. That's usually got, you know, stats, statistics and all kinds of numbers and that kind of thing that could make a nice presentation and maybe spice up sometimes an otherwise pretty boring effort. So why not try and get your congregation reading the annual report by putting together one of these with some of these really awesome tools. They're really easy to use.
Great idea. All right, next up, a link from Wells Intersections to Nonprofit Marketing, 8 Ways to Grow Your Mission with Videos. So we talked a little bit earlier about storytelling with videos, and they actually have that as their number one, use video to tell your stories, but then they go on and tell you other uses for video, capture interest, get social, get personal, keep it brief, educate about your cause, remember mobile, and include a call to action. So a little bit different spin than the earlier article where they're just kind of giving you tips for sharing and ideas and things to help engage your audience with the videos that you're producing. So seemed like a good read, and certainly infographics are a way to tell a story these days. Video is very powerful. I'm just kind of impressed by, especially on my mobile device, it seems like they bring up more and more videos in my Facebook feed. So as I'm scrolling through and I want to read people's updates, I'm seeing more and more people sharing and videos interjected in different ways where you just scroll down the page and they start autoplaying all the time now. So more and more emphasis on video communication as time goes by.
I've noticed that as well. Yeah, and I've left that on. You can turn that off in settings if you don't want it to autoplay, because that does take up some bandwidth if you're on the road or whatever. But yeah, I'd say just in the past 6 to 8 months, I've seen so much more of that from recipes that are being kind of made. I don't know if you've seen those.
Yeah.
The the top-down shot, somebody putting together a recipe to who knows what. So.
Yeah, very popular stuff. Who knows what? That's right. It's kind of like going to a garage sale. You never know what. You just have to be open to the possibilities. Right. Sometimes you don't want to be open to those possibilities. All right. Next up from Wells Intersections, this one was my favorite. I even colored it yellow in the mind map because this had definite implications for me. How to add and manage multiple accounts on Instagram. This is not a feature that they had available until pretty recently on Instagram, but in your settings of your Instagram account, there's actually a link that says add account. You can log into multiple accounts, and then once logged in, it'll tell you which account you're on in the top bar area, and there's an arrow where you can select a different account. And so very powerful, and gets you over having to log out and log in on your phone, because you can't manage your Instagram account anywhere else but your mobile device. It doesn't work on a desktop. You have to do it on your mobile device, and that manual logging out and typing in the username and password can get really old. So having up to 5 Instagram accounts with 1 login really will be a huge time saver for me.
Yeah, anybody involved with the social network or social media stuff with their church or school might likely have this issue if the church or your organization has an Instagram account and you have your own. Yeah, I can imagine that's going to be a great time saver.
Definitely. If you're involved with a podcast, you might have this issue too, as we have a Wells Tech Instagram account. All right, one more from Wells Intersections. Lots of good stuff out there. Go check it out. But this one is titled, 8 Things Your Church Website Must Have. I thought it'd be a fun little exercise to read through the list, and you guys that are watching and listening can kind of check off the things that you have that, according to them, are must-haves for your church or school website. Staff names and titles, information about your children's ministry and youth ministry. Many parents want to know and expect their kids to have opportunities like that, so that's a good thing to include. Sermon archives, the ever-popular church calendar, contact information. I oftentimes am just trying to figure out where it's located. Just tell me the address in a visible way, either in the header or the footer, somewhere where I can find it easily and quickly. A statement of beliefs certainly is an important component of your website. Links to social media profiles and major church news items. So, kind of make a mental tour of your church site and see how many of those you're able to check off the list and maybe adopt one that's missing if there's something that you can explore adding to your site.
Yep. One thing that I would add would be a visitor's guide. I've always told the workshops that I lead on this topic that if you don't really have a visitor's guide, you're not giving somebody exactly kind of what they might be needing, like an FAQ, something like that, what to expect. So good stuff. Are we on to Instagram?
I think it's your turn. Yes, sir. Instagram.
We already talked about Instagram and the cool new features that they've added for at Sally's request. But I'm not a huge Instagram user, but I think there's a lot of opportunities here for ministry. And I posted a picture just last week of about this time last year. I was up in Fairbanks, Alaska, doing a workshop on productivity, and I got up close to the Alaska pipeline and took a picture with my iPhone and posted it on Instagram just this past week as kind of the anniversary of that rather cold trip. But the backstory is, and it's obviously very easy to do, but the backstory is if you're trying to figure out or kind of capture or collect information like we are for a community feedback show, are there some tools that can help us? So are there tools that can go out there and look for all the hashtag Wells Techs, you know, across Twitter and Digo and Instagram and Facebook and Pinterest? And it turns out that one of our best friends, one of our best one of the best tools, I should say, that is our best friend is IFTTT, if then, then that. Allows you to create recipes that will just kind of listen for or look for whatever search term you want to give it. Now, it doesn't work in all the social networks, but in many of them. And then what we're able to do is, well whenever you see that, grab a link to it or grab as much metadata as you can about it and plug it into a Google Sheet. And that's exactly what I was kind of curious how far I could go. And three or four social networks, I could do that in an automated fashion. So when it comes time for community feedback, we just go to the spreadsheet, look at all the things that are there based on if then, then that recipes, and away you go. So there's application for this, I think, in church or school setting as well. If you're running campaigns, if you're encouraging people to use a hashtag for an event, that kind of stuff, you can aggregate them in a more automated fashion. You can also search for other terms as well, just to see what's going on the internet, maybe about your particular church or school or event that you have as well. So if you're not familiar with IFTTT, get on over there. They do a lot of things with home automation, with things like this, with capturing images, moving things around, just kind of a good life organizer, just hundreds and hundreds of recipes that might connect different tools that you already use. So,
Martin, I can tell you now that you have passed my husband's criteria for a good programmer, because programmers are not by nature hard workers. They're lazy, according to him, and they want to automate things, and that's what you did for us. You automated that collection of community feedback information. So thank you for that programming mind and attribute that you displayed there.
I would say it's a pretty easy process if you've ever used it, but one of the disappointments was its integration with Facebook, which is it's the biggest social network out there. And there just weren't the tools necessary to do exactly what I was saying. So I can't grab Facebook stuff. Most of the rest of the stuff is publicly available and plugged in there. So chances are good.
Good to know.
Just go there and see some of the example recipes, and you may be intrigued by what's possible. You can send yourself alarms and all kinds of stuff. So. It's cool.
Yep.
Shall we move on to news and tech, Sally?
I'm okay with that, but we could skip right over if you wanted.
What's that?
I happen to have thrown an article in there that I think might stir up a little controversy. You just never know.
Already has.
Yeah. It actually was something probably many of you have seen in various news feeds and things that you follow, but it was a message from last Tuesday, February 16th, that Apple's CEO, Chief Operating Officer, Tim Cook, CEO, there you go, published to their customer base. It was basically an open letter to their customer, and it related to an act of terrorism that occurred, I believe, in the San Francisco area, somewhere
in California.
Southern
California.
There you go.
Yeah.
It occurred recently, and the fact that the people that carried it out had iPhones, and they were password-protected iPhones, and now through the investigation, it's the desire of the government to have Apple unlock those phones for them. So Apple's basically taking the stance that that would be a major security breach and an infringement on people's rights and things to allow it in this specific case. And they make a pretty good argument, depending on whose perspective you ask, about the need for encryption and the reason that they want to be respectful of the encryption that they've installed on iPhones. And like I said, I guess it kind of stirred up a little bit of conversation around it.
Yep. I think, yeah, a lot of conversation, and it'll be interesting to see how this gets played out. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if this went to the Supreme Court at some point. And that'll be an interesting conversation there, given the, you know, the makeup of the court. And I guess it's not even an issue that runs along political lines, even. I'm not so sure it's a Republican versus Democrat thing. But one thing that's kind of been misreported is it's really not an issue of encryption. So the FBI is not asking Apple to decrypt a phone. They're asking Apple to push up a firmware update to this particular phone that would disable the limits that they have placed on their phones for consecutive failed password attempts, so that if that were not there, the FBI could go in and, through what they would call a brute force attack, kind of type in all the numbers so they could actually break the code to get into the phone, as if the terrorist would have with their own phone. And so it's not about breaking that encryption. It's about asking Apple to disable one of the security features on it. So the fact that Apple starts their article by saying, well, everybody needs encryption, is a little bit disingenuous to me. So I think both sides are probably positioning this for, you know, the public eye. Apple's saying, hey, we're strong on security, we're protecting your rights, well, if the FBI can't open your phone, nobody can, so buy our phone. And the FBI is kind of handpicking a case, I think, to maybe get a law or get a precedent set that would allow them to get into any phone, you know, that they would need. So it's, and through public pressure, basically saying, well, this is an act of terrorism that we have to stop in the future. And if you don't give us the ability to get at all this information, then we're not going to be able to keep you safe. So it's a really politically charged argument, I think.
And I think we'll see it, like you said, play out in the court system most likely. I'm curious as to how fast it'll escalate, because it seems, you know, a very timely thing to be able to get to the bottom of this in this particular case. You know, they don't want to tie it up for a long, long period of time or whatever. The article goes into a lot more detail, and you know, and I do think it's a question of swaying the public. When I first read it, I could definitely, you know, feel the rally cry of too much Big Brother, and they don't need to be in my business that way, and if they can do this, they can read everyone's. But on the opposite side of it, obviously, you know, they're going through extreme, you know, processes to get to this just one phone, almost like a search warrant. You know, it's not taken lightly. It's not something that they're unlocking for the FBI for every single iPhone that's out there or whatever. So,
it's a very complicated issue, and ultimately it needs to get solved so that everybody knows where they stand. And even if I think the FBI, or if the FBI wins this, which I'm thinking they probably will in some way or another, the bad guys are still going to be able to encrypt their stuff. There's all kinds of encryption methodologies that are out there that can protect their information. So the smart bad guys will have their information protected. The dumb bad guys will not. So it's going to run it when it's normal course. One thing that I think is kind of unfortunate, Sally, is you get a sense that there's a sentiment out there of distrust for law enforcement, especially, you know, and the government in general. And you see that, and this is not a technology issue, but you see that in the news, and you see that in the protests and whatever, that, you know, the first impression, the first statement, the first reaction is always, well, what's the government up to now? And that's unfortunate, and that's anti-biblical. I mean, God says that we owe them honor and respect, and I think there's a lot of public sentiment, especially and in media too, that works against that. So that's too bad.
I will move on then to one more news and tech. Martin, I added it at the last second. I'm not sure if you're seeing it there, but it was an article from our friends at The Guru. They're all about Google products, Google Apps for Education, and just Google products in general. And an article released that Gmail has released an Android-only app at this time. It's called Gmailify, and it allows you to have Gmail features without a Gmail address. So you get Gmail spam protection, filtering options between social updates and promotional emails. You get speedy search and just improved mail notifications on your phone in general. So this would be for things like your Outlook mail or your Hotmail or Yahoo account. You could set it up through this Android app and then get this kind of higher level overarching Gmail knowledge base applied to your email account that lives other places.
And you don't use an Android phone, and I'm not using one right now either, so I can't play with this. But the Gmail client is actually very, very, very good, and I think they're trying to leverage that. So this is only on Android and only with the Gmail app, not the Inbox app, as far as I can tell, which is what I actually use on iOS, which I really like, and on the web as well. So pretty limited, but I think they're planning to roll this out. One of the best features, I think, Sally, maybe you experienced this too, and kind of the make or break of email clients that I use, is a consolidated inbox. I really hate going from account to account to account trying to read through email or whatever. I like the tools that allow me to bring it all into one inbox, and if I'm going to process email, I'm going to process all the accounts that I have, and I have a number of them, and maybe that's just my problem. But I think in general, people these days are having more than one email, and it's a bummer to have to go to different accounts and kind of switch tools or switch areas, whatever, just to read email.
Yeah, come to think of it, that's why I like to settle down with my phone and whip through my email really quickly and clean up my inbox, my consolidated inbox, without having to go to each of those different
ones. Mail app on,
I do use the mail app, so it brings in my Outlook, my Gmail accounts.
How do you like that? I mean, you use it, so apparently you've decided that works for you. Any frustrations with that?
No, I've been really pleased with it. I've tried other things, and I just think, you know, for the power of that consolidated look, it works for
me. Yeah, that's one of the big features there. So, okay, good. Shall we move along to our picks?
I think so. And I'm actually returning to the Guru website because I read a great article there about the new updates to Google Forms. And I'm a Google Forms fan and thought this was a good short list of four different updates. The first thing they list is that you can use templates. You don't have to start from scratch. And I had a little trouble finding this. Normally when I'm doing a new Google form, I go to Google and my Google Drive account and I click new form. I don't typically go to it from the forms.google.com page. But if you do go to that page, that's where you're going to see number of templates that are available there. And they have things, you know, featured templates, education templates, things like course evaluations or something they're calling their exit ticket, which is the end of day check-in kind of tool that you could use. They have personal templates with party invitations or event registrations. They have work templates like job applications and time off requests and things like that. So if you click one of these, then right away you get a pre-filled form. It has design, it has questions, and then you can edit it to your heart's desire. So templates are brand new for Google Forms. Next up, you can use add-ons with Google Forms, and these I'm most excited about. So I have a sample Google Form here. Different design look to it. The add-ons are actually tucked away in this icon in the upper right. And Martin, I'm going to fact check here. Is this called an ellipse icon? Is that what you would call the three vertical dots?
Well, I would call it an ellipsis if it were on its side. I don't know what they call it if it's vertical. We'll have to come up with, there's probably a name for it, but I have no idea what it is.
Maybe we should name it the snowman.
Menu, but yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a snowman because we got three circles there. Anyway, the three dots. Yeah, the skinny snowman. In the skinny snowman menu, you can get add-ons, and it's a very familiar experience for those of you that have used add-ons and other Google Drive tools. Pops up and lists a bunch of add-ons. They have form publisher, form notifications, choice eliminator, form limiter, just on and on. You can use math symbols. You can get an app sheet to build a custom mobile app based on your Google form, quick and easy. So I would love to spend the time and go through all of these add-ons. I just can't tell you yet which ones are my favorites, but I think there's going to be some cool extensions to your form capabilities with these various add-ons that are now available in Google Forms. Next up, they said you can track survey progress and analyze results, and then finally receive notifications and status updates. And both of those things are actually tucked away in a new tab that's available. So they have a questions tab where you build out your form questions, and then they have a responses tab. And since this isn't a real live form that's gotten responses, not a great demonstration of it, but you would have your stats available here that you normally would have to get to in other places in the old menu system. And then under the dot, dot, dots, you can turn on that notifications that used to only be in the spreadsheet that was storing your data. You couldn't turn on notifications from the form itself, which was kind of backward, but now they've built that into the new Google Forms. The article doesn't specifically mention the design changes to Google Forms, but if you were familiar with the old forms, you can tell that it's a very minimalistic design. They've kind of tucked away things in the skinny snowman icon for the different questions and things that are available here, new floating toolbar here and things like that. I just want to tell you this little guy down in the lower left corner is an escape artist. So if you just can't stand the new Google Forms, you can click the escaping guy and run right back to the safety of old Google Forms and the interface that you're familiar with there. I can't guarantee how long that will last, though. Obviously, they're pushing hard. They're making this now the default instead of just making the new Google Forms available. Now the new Google Forms is the default, and you can go backwards to the old. But I would guess that old option is going to go away sooner or later. So time to get familiar. One thing I'd like to see them do before it goes away is up the ante on the design. You basically just have different color choices, or you can use the icon that looks like an image to bring in an image for the header area. But besides that, in the old Google Forms, you could get very granular with all the different components of the form in terms of design, and that's not baked into the new Google Forms as of yet. So that's the big piece that I see missing, where you can control font colors and font choices and background colors and a lot of different things about the forms. That's not here as of yet. So
that's
we'll see if that
shows
up soon.
The bottom right there.
It isn't. These are adding sections and things like that. So that, I went and dug through some help. I think I even found the help about that, and it doesn't exist yet in the new Google Forms. But the help said it's not there yet. It was Google's help. It gave me the impression that they're still building that out. So I'm hoping to see that added soon enough.
Okay. So that's a good that was a great tour. I think one of the considerations that you need to make when you pick a forms tool, and we've talked about Google Forms a lot in the past, and we've talked about Jot Forms, those kinds of things, is not just the tool itself, but what kind of add-on or ecosystem is around it that can extend it for the things that you want. And Google Forms has, just like you showed, a ton of those capabilities that you can put on top of it, add the exact functionality that's going to make it work in your situation. And not all forms tools have that. You know, I'm thinking of like Final Web's form tools. It's pretty, vanilla, straightforward. It does what it does, but there's no ecosystem around it. Here's an example of a tool where you can build it up as you go and add things on to make it fit your needs. So good. Yep. That whole design is what Google calls material design, the kind of the minimalistic, square, primary colors, look and feel. So that's looks like their first step toward adhering to their own design principles too. So you see it on the phone as well.
Yep.
All right. My pick of the week is something that I knew about but really had never explored or tried, and that's a website called Udemy, UDEMY.com, and it's a learning site. If you go to udemy.com, you're going to see, let me go there quickly, you're going to see all kinds of courses and on all kinds of different topics. I was kind of drawn to some of the mobile app development stuff, but they have business courses, IT, office productivity, personal development, design, marketing, lifestyle, photography, health and fitness, teacher training, music, academics, language, and test prep. Just a ton of courses. It's kind of, I would maybe equate it to lynda.com in that sense, although there's one big difference. The way Lynda works is they kind of go out and recruit teachers, and they kind of curate that. Udemy is kind of a user-generated course development system. So not only can you come in here and use courses, and each course costs something, so it's a per course price tag. Right now, up until I think the end of February maybe, or maybe even just the end of this week, is a sale, $15 for almost every course, and they're normally a lot more expensive than that. So if you're interested in trying one of these out, go over to the site and, plop down your $15. Each of the courses has little previews, so you can kind of see what the course is about. And then some of the episodes or lectures, they call them, are also previewable. But there's a good search tool here. And if you are somebody who creates courses, this might be something for you to consider. So if you're a subject matter expert on a particular topic that might fit in one of their categories, it walks you through the whole process, how to upload your videos, how to upload the course objectives. You can put in quizzes, those kinds of things. And then it lives on Udemy, and people can purchase it, or you can make it free, either one. You set the price. If you want Udemy to advertise it, they take a cut, and I think it's like 40% or something like that, maybe even 50%, or you can advertise it yourself but still host it here. So they're going to host all the videos. The interface is very cool, so when you go into a course, let's see if I can open this up, you can, obviously you can take the course. The coupons, the $15 coupon is available till February 27th, by the way. And it tells you all about the course, and then you can see, you can take previews or look at previews and see all of the lectures that are available. Some can be written, some can be video, so you can intermix those. I almost equate it to like a iTunes U environment, but I think in a much more pleasing and simpler way. It'll tell you each course how many students have enrolled in it. So one of their most popular ones I'm seeing here, the Complete Web Developer course, built 14 websites, had 212,000 students enrolled over the course of its of its history, long history. So there's a rating system, so you get an idea of how good the course is. So if you're looking for something in particular, and you can, there's foreign language courses. So if I search on Spanish, it'll show me all the Spanish courses, and you can select the level, etc. So just all kinds of things that you could click around on and see what makes sense for you. So if you're a lifelong learner, or if you're a teacher who wants to get some material out there, Udemy.com might be for you.
Great tour, Martin.
You ever heard of that?
I wasn't familiar. No. Probably somewhere on a Digo list of mine, but not something I've dug into at that level. So good stuff.
Yep, give it a shot. Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to ministry resources.
Sure. I'm happy to share with you a site I came across recently through Facebook feeds and things. It's called onmyheart.com, and all those words are hyphenated, on-my-heart.com. It's a Lutheran memory work program. It consists of downloadable PDFs organized into four sets, thinking that a set would be used per semester. So it's basically a two-year program. Each set is divided by books of the Bible, Luther's Small Catechism, Bible passages, and Bible timeline. And so students, perhaps at a young age, would begin to work through these. If you use their downloads, you download, cut them apart, bind them with a ring binder, and work your way through basically kind of a flashcards type feel for the four different categories. And as I said, there's a four sets of them, so one per semester. The idea is that they would cover a card a week with their memorization. It's really interesting that they've made it available for free and easy download. And if you go to their download page, you can select between, let's see if my mouse catches up with me, the ELS or Wells Catechism translation. You can select a Bible version or translation from NIV 84 or New King James, and then you can select one of the four sets to download. And then you just click the download button. They give you some instructions for printing and assembling the cards. Here's a quick look at one collection of downloads. So this is the Old Testament books section, where they're working through memorizing a selection of the books and then putting it all together, moving into New Testament books and doing the same thing. And again, you would print it two-sided and cut them apart and bind them into the ring binder. They have some timeline things here where they're helping the students to learn the order of different Bible studies and stories they've learned along the way, so that they can kind of put together the stories in a timeline historically. And then they have Bible passages, and typically several per week. So you have a lot of Bible passages that you're memorizing along the way. They tie them to the catechism lessons that you're studying and things like that. And then they have a section on reviewing the catechism. And this particular semester, it's on the commandments. So it looks like a really well-done product that they're giving away here for free. We've actually been in contact with the folks behind the website, and we're hoping to have them on the show at some point to talk more about On My Heart and the program that they've developed here. Happy to share that with folks.
Awesome. I mean, this is great. I think that the concept is so simple, and now with the just kind of the formatting of this, it looks like it's a no-brainer for anybody wanting to create flashcards for catechism class.
Yeah, I'm nicely thinking I could use a set of flashcards to study. Wouldn't hurt me a bit, would it?
Yep, very nice.
Yeah,
nice catch.
Real nice.
Yeah. Yep. So what's our featured video this week?
Our featured video this week is on Vimeo, and it's from our friends at Divine Savior Lutheran Academy down in Doral, Florida. They have a beautiful pre-K through high school campus that they featured in this wonderful video, and kind of goes sunrise to sunset, and all the activities going on in the campus gives you a real good look and feel for what is happening there at Divine Savior. So check it out.
A good example of what could be done and
right,
for your school or church. So
very well done.
I'm excited for next week because we're going to be focusing on ed tech again, and one of our semi-regular classroom technology correspondents is going to join us, Gail Potratz, for a lively discussion on kind of a neat report, the Horizon Report from the New Media Consortium. The K-12 Horizon Report comes out every year, and making some prognostications and a little bit of things to think about. And Gail's going to come on the show to help us think about moving students from consumers to creators. So tune in next week for that.
Should be interesting. Looking forward to it.
All right, and we really appreciate your participation in the show, you listeners and viewers, because your feedback crafted the agenda for the show. If you'd like to give us more feedback, and we wish you would, go to wellstech.wells.net for our show notes page. There, of course, you can find the audio and video files of all the previous shows and all of our picks and resources and book reviews, etc. But you also have a way to get in touch with us there and share your stuff with the show. And all the links across the top, Google+, Twitter, Facebook, Digo, Pinterest, Instagram, all the ones we talked about today. I think we got something from almost every one of them today. You can find there, and we would love it if you would put your two cents in there and we could talk about it on the show. So take advantage of that, and if you just want to send us an email, we'll take those too, wellstech@wells.net. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Blessings on your Lenten journey, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.